coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation. It's your host, Doug Hagman.
And welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report for today. It's Thursday, June 29th, 2023. I just want to welcome everyone. Thank you so much for your belief and your trust in us. Do me a favor, folks. Go to HagmanPI.com. From there, you can select Rumble or Brighteon. We're on both platforms as well as all of the audio platforms. But with respect to Rumble or Brighteon, do me a favor, please subscribe. It doesn't cost you anything to subscribe. You subscribe and you get notified of the program. You can give a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or, you know, give me the finger, I guess. I don't know. Some finger. Anyway, favorites or what have you. But bookmark HagmanPI.com, and in the program description part, if you click on the title for today's show, obviously all of the links that we talk about. And we're going to be talking about some interesting things. You can follow, go directly to everything we talk about by way of those links. And don't forget, this weekend we have a meeting of our supporters, 7 p.m. Eastern time on Sunday. By way of Zoom, you'll be getting, or you know how to sign in, folks. You know how to do that. So, and if you want to become a supporter, just go to HagmanPI.com. And I think I'll have a surprise for you on Sunday. I'm working on that. We'll see how it plays out. But there it is, right there on your screen. If you look there, you can see where to go, and you just fill that out, and bada bing, bada bang, there you go, and you can be part of be a supporter and part of the interactive meeting that we have. Very meaningful. Man, am I excited right now? I am absolutely beyond, and I mean that. In a good way. In studio with me are two of my favorite people, and I mean that. I'm serious when I say that. A very prolific writer, and man, this guy is one of the best writers I know. Jack Cashel. Jack Cashel is the author. You ready for this? Okay. Now I'm just going to give you three books. Actually, four, but three. I'm going to show you this. I think this might have been one of the first books I read of Jack Cashel. Ron Brown's Body. Okay, man, did I learn a lot from this. Yeah. You remember Ron Brown, right? You remember Clinton, right? Enough said. Okay. And then something happened. The anniversaries were the same anniversary. I hate to use that word when it comes to events like this. TWA 800. You talk about an investigative journal. My goodness. He gets into the real story behind TWA 800. And then, I can't even say this is my favorite, but it's one of my favorites because they're all my favorite. Yeah, that's right. Unmasking Obama. Look at that picture. Does that look like he's unmasked there? I don't know. Again, Jack Cashel, the ever prolific writer. And of course, he writes for numerous platforms, including American Thinker and others. You know, Jack was born and raised in, listen to this, Newark, New Jersey. And this is kind of why we're here, in a sense. He graduated from Regis High School in Siena College, and received his PhD in American Studies. I guess that's, you have to say the letters in suppose of the word. From Purdue University, relevant to this particular project, Mr. Cashel worked for the, you ready? Newark Housing Authority and the Housing Authority of Kansas City. He also taught urban studies through the Fulbright program at the University of Nancy in France. I didn't know that. I don't know why I didn't know that, but anyway, Untenable is his newest book, and that's why he's here. Untenable is Mr. Cashel's 15th, count them, 15th publication. His 15th published work of nonfiction. And You know, I read, look, folks, let me tell you something. This book is not yet out, but because I'm special, okay, because I'm special, I have a copy, and I read the book. It helps to know the author. It does. But when I read this book, it just sucked me in. I mean, like all of his other books, but this is a story about not just about Jack and about what's but this is a story about Jack and about what's going on in America today in a larger sense. There's a quote that Jack reminded me of, and I forgot about this at the beginning of the book by Dostoevsky. Excuse me, I can't pronounce that name. Tell the story of your village. If you tell it well, you will have told the story of the world. And that is why we're here today, in a sense. You know, look at what's happening in the United States specifically. Look at what's happening with this white replacement, right? Just keep that in the back of your mind. I want to read something from the back of the book here. I asked one lifelong friend, a rare Democrat among the displaced, why he and his widowed mother finally left our block in the early 1970s, 20 years after the first African-American families moved in. Now listen to this, and think about this, your parents, your friends, your coworkers, think about this in that context, maybe yourself. He searched for a minute for the right set of words, and then he simply said, it became untenable. When I asked him what that meant by untenable, or what he meant by untenable, he answered, when your mother gets mugged for the second time, that's untenable. When your home gets broken into for the second time, that's untenable. In researching this project, I found myself repeatedly stunned by the failure of self-described experts on white flight to ask those accused of fleeing why it was they fled. The reason the experts didn't ask, I discovered, is that they were afraid of what they might learn. And boy, I'll tell you what, how dead on accurate that is. And you know, I know you guys do this. You go to Twitter, TikTok, whatever, and you see scene after scene of violence take place, right? And we are always accused. Well, it's, you know, white supremacists. Don't forget, you and I, because I'm white, even Jack, he's on the list. Merrick Garland's list of white supremacists. So is Eric the Tech. He wears that as a badge of pride, though. I'm kidding, but the fact of the matter is, you know what's going on in America. Well, through his book, and you know how I love to read, Untenable. That's right. I got a copy right here. It's not out yet, but you can order it right now. In fact, do me a favor. Do yourself a favor, not just me. Do yourself a favor. Go to Amazon.com and order this book. There it is right there on your screen. The link will be in the program description box at HagmanPI.com. Untenable. The true story of white ethnic flight from America's cities. And think about that. Isn't that what's going on right now? It absolutely is. This book tells Jack, he tells his story, and he tells really the story of America. Hence the quote by the name I can't pronounce, or I try to pronounce it and it screws it up, and what do I know? But with me, I'm proud to present Jack Cashel. Jack, how are you, sir?
Doug, I am doing great. And, you know, I drove here. Yeah, and the timing of the show is great. I was driving in from Kansas City. I have a place on Lake Erie. But the last, you know, just a little digression, the blanket of mist that covered the America and the drive across, I felt like that character in the Invisible Shrinking Man. Remember this?
Yep.
Incredible Shrinking
Yep.
Man?
Yep.
So if during the course of this show, I end up being like 3'6" or 2'3", you'll understand why. Something, for the last 3 years, I felt like a character in a science fiction movie, and I don't know how it turns out, you know, so.
Oh, yeah.
But it's, But thanks for having me. And that's that Dostoevsky quote really speaks to what I tried to do in this book. And that is, I tell the story of my village.
Yeah.
Which isn't Newark, but it's Roseville. It's my neighborhood in Newark. It's an unassuming neighborhood, one of 1,000 comparable neighborhoods throughout America. And I expand from there. I start with there, but I talk about other cities and other places. But this is really written for people who either experienced what I did, and there's millions of us, and we've never had our story told before, and especially for those people to share with their children and their grandchildren. So they'll say, I always wonder why old cranky Uncle George felt the way he does about X, Y, or Z, right? They don't know. And I only wish I had written it earlier when my parents' generation was still around, because they're the ones who really bore the brunt of it. And millions of people fled the cities in the 60s and 70s for a very specific reason.
Yeah.
Crime in schools. And black people fled, Asians fled, Hispanics fled, whites fled. But only whites were shamed for fleeing. And we still are.
Yes.
And I use the collective we here, but the we at that time wasn't collective. Because as a kid growing up, I thought of myself as Irish. Other people in the neighborhood thought of themselves as Italians or Jewish or German or Puerto Rican. And then all of a sudden we were lumped together as white, and then we were condemned for being white.
Right.
And if we left, we were condemned. If we stayed, TV gave us Archie Bunker as our model of who we were.
Right, exactly.
They condescended to us. They still do. And they refused to tackle this subject. It's a sensitive subject. I get that. Some people are afraid of it. I write very tactfully, as you can attest.
Yes.
But I, as with all the books I write, I write about people. I don't want to just, large statistics on top of statistics. And in fact, in Unmasking Obama, which you just showed, I'm going to make a quick digression here in a second.
Sure. Yeah.
But, the publisher wanted a book about Obama. I didn't want to write about Obama. I wanted to write about the people who exposed Obama. Oh. I want to tell their stories.
Yeah.
Because virtually every scandal was from the ground up. It was done from the grassroots up, not from the top down. And we have one of those people here with us today, which is kind of cool. So,
yeah. In fact, I'm not even sure I finished that thought. Susan Daniels, the PI. My goodness. I my apologies, Susan. But Susan Daniels is here with me as well, and a brand new author. So we'll be talking about her book here later or for the show for tomorrow. But anyway, absolutely. Interesting. How you wrote this book and how you wrote it without citing statistics. I don't know how you did what you did, but you got the points across, if that makes sense.
Well, it's my most personal story, obviously, I've ever written. And I'm on a cover, you want to show the cover?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if you could zoom in on that, but the cover tells a story that's in and of itself.
Right.
This is we're a working class family in Newark, and circa 1957. I'm on the right, the boy on the right.
It would be
where right I belong. Here. They put me on the right from the beginning of my photos.
There you go.
You look at that picture. This is just an average family. Every family looked like that on Easter 1957, right?
Yep.
We're all dressed in suits. We're all going to church. My little sister's wearing a bonnet, and
I remember
there's
those
a mother
days.
And a father, right?
Yeah.
And what I did is I found I grew up on a block in Newark called Myrtle Avenue, one block long, narrow street. So there were about 360 people living on a block,
right?
In 1950, just in the way of background, I got very lucky writing this book in several ways. One is that they release censuses every 72 years. I mean, they wait 72 years to release the census. Don't ask me why.
Wow.
It's like JFK's brain or something. You got to wait 72 years.
All right.
Well, so the 1950 census was released in 2022. And I looked at my block in 1950. And it was there were 83 households on the block.
Okay.
I'm not going to make it a guessing game. 81 of the 83 households had a male head of household.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't, in 1950, that was not a big deal. That was the expectation. So there were two widows on the block, and of the other households, 81 had a male head.
Okay.
If we went to that block today, it's likely there'd be 0 to 2 male heads of households married on a given street. And that, in a nutshell, is the story of the collapse of urban America.
Right.
Of the black community in urban America, and to an increasing degree, the white community as well.
And I see that comment quite a bit. What do these people have in common? Obviously, the people that are causing trouble, that are committing these horrendous crimes. You see,
right.
Just about every time you see one of those, what do they have in common? There's always someone that comes in there and says, "Absent a father figure. Father figure is absent." And I believe that.
No, and that's, and it goes back to what I talk about in here is the report by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, which was written in 1965.
Yep.
And it was about the Negro family. I mean, that's the phrase he used.
Right.
And Moynihan would go on to become a U.S. senator.
Mm-hmm.
He was like the last truth teller in the Democratic Party. And although the more he got into Democratic politics, the less truth he could tell. But he was an undersecretary of labor working for Lyndon Johnson in 65. And 65 would just happen the same year that Johnson launched the Great Society.
Right.
So he institutionalized the trends that had been brewing for the last 10 years. That is the understanding now that you were no longer responsible for yourself. Society was the system is what made you who you were. Major transformation in American thinking. But Moynihan points out, he says, listen, 25% of black kids are living in households without a father. On my block growing up, and it was an integrated block, I knew one kid. And we called him, I referred to him in the book as Broken Home Bobby. He was the only guy in the block without a father in a home. And he lived with his uncle, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't like he was in an unstructured home. It was so rare, to vanishingly rare. And when, at that same time, in black neighborhoods where the riots broke out in 67, 25% of the kids are fatherless. Well, what Moynihan says was incredibly prescient. He says that now with the passage of Civil Rights Act in 64 and Voting Rights Act in 65, there's going to be a growing expectation among African Americans for equity. They'll expect equal outcomes because now they have equal rights. He says, that's not going to happen.
Okay.
Because he goes, unless we can work on restructuring and solidifying the black family, they will never catch up. In fact, they'll fall further and further behind. Now, in a city like Newark, they're competing with ethnic, by the way, Newark rhymes with pork or cork.
Yeah.
The way God intended it to rhyme. It's not Newark or, Newark. It's Newark. And there were four dominant ethnic groups when I was growing up, Irish, Italian, Jewish, and black.
Right.
And each had roughly comparable power blocks in terms of political power. But the Irish, the Italians, and the Catholics, I'm sorry, the Irish, Italian, Jews all had one thing in common. That was very strong family formation. There was very little divorce, very few broken homes. So you're coming from a community where, at that time, one out of every four kids is growing up without a father. And you're competing against families where everyone has fathers.
Right.
And you're not going to keep up. So in 1950s, the gap between whites and blacks was narrowing in terms of income. Starting in 1960, 62, what he saw was that when welfare rates historically, when unemployment went down, welfare went down. Right?
That makes sense, yeah.
He said, starting in 1960, when unemployment went down, welfare kept going up. He said, this is a bad trend. And he writes this report, and it gets a lot of attention. And at first, everyone inside the White House said, boy, this is really on target. And then the civil rights community, such as it was at the time, weighs in, suppress that report. We don't want anything to do with it.
Mm.
Because if it's perceived that the real problem isn't systemic racism, external factors, white supremacists, but rather the collapse of our own families, we don't have any value anymore. What's our value? Now, Barack Obama learned this the hard way, and I talk about this in the book.
Yep.
In 2008, and his one good speech as a presidential candidate, Father's Day, June 16th, 2008, you can look this one up. The audio still exists. I don't know if there's a video. He's speaking at the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago. This is Jesse Jackson territory.
Right.
Jesse Jackson's been milking this movement for the last 40 years since he swathed his shirt in Martin Luther King's blood. I mean, that's he was that much of an opportunist.
Right.
So Obama gives a speech and he says, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we have to acknowledge that the greatest problem in Black America now is the absence of fathers in our households.
That's right.
He goes, more than half of the kids in Black America now live without a father in home, a number that's fully doubled in a generation, right? And then he goes through the statistics. Fatherless children are 4 or 5 times more likely to be in poverty, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, 20 times more likely to end up in prison.
Yep.
And the major media kind of quiet about the talk. They weren't really going to celebrate this, but Obama's now, he has the nomination wrapped up. He's centering himself, you know, appealing to the, you know, broader electorate. 3 weeks later, on a hot mic, Jesse Jackson is in a Fox News studio where he doesn't know the mic is on, right, Jesse? I don't believe that. But he says, and I'm going to be this is a little cold here. I'll just say the first half, the second half, get you thrown off the air. But he says, Obama talking down to Black people. I want to cut his nuts out with that slashing motion, right?
Right.
And then he added something about the N-word, but yeah, I'm not going to say it because who knows what the consequences are today. We'll have the FBI come visit us before the show's over.
That's a given anyway, but go on.
Jesse Jackson, when he uses the N-word, doesn't use it in asterisks. You know, he doesn't speak in asterisks. He's allowed a certain freedom we're not. In any case, that was and that message got back to Obama quickly. It was the last time he ever spoke out about fatherhood, which is a shame because he's a good father himself. I mean, there's a lot of things I distrust about Obama, but I think he's been a good father. And the opportunity was lost, and the problem continued. And what happened then is that we had thought, naively, even those of us who didn't vote for Obama, that Black America would take heart at his election. And they'd begin to say, hey, we are part of America. There is a world. This is a nation of opportunity. But the opposite happened.
Yeah, which is, why? I don't get that. I'll just stop there. Why?
Well, you know, what happened, I think what he learned, and I think left to his own devices, he would not have done this. But he was married to a woman who was just resentful, hateful, mean-spirited, who dislikes white people, and which is evident throughout her career.
Yeah.
And part of it, and she has the same problem that Obama does, Obama more so, is they're insecure in their Blackness. Obama, for understandable reasons, he grew up in a white household and has a white mother and raised by his white grandparents and lived in the whitest state in America. And then he's thrown back into the United States and he's got to make believe that he's an African-American. He doesn't know where to begin. Whereas Michelle, and Joel Gilbert points this out pretty well in his book and movie, Michelle Obama 2024, kind of grew up similarly. Her parents, she had a two-parent family. She was being harassed by her neighbor girlfriends for speaking white.
Right.
She and her brother flee the neighborhood to go to high school. She's been, as Joel argues, then successfully, she's been fleeing her neighborhood all her life. So she compensates by acting Black, by... It's a complicated psychology, but needless to say, we did not solve any problems under Obama. We just aggravated problems. Whenever something bad happened, it was because of race. Why else would we vote against his budget? Well, because we're racist. Why else would we oppose, let's say, Obamacare? Well, we're racist. Why else would the Tea Party form the protest tax increase. Well, because we're racist.
Right, yeah.
And he never stopped the media from using that trick or his supporters from using that trick. And as a net result, they began to believe it.
Yeah. And others are using that, to me anyway, that same template. You wrote about this. I don't recall the number of the chapter, but the chapter name, Divided Highway.
Yeah.
Or Divided Highways, plural, page 113, and about how the Secretary of Transportation currently, Pete
Buttigieg.
No. Yeah.
I had to redo the audio because I mispronounced his name.
I was going to say.
My wife says, you mispronounced his name. I said, well, it's not. No, who's going to know? Should you go back there and redo that? Okay.
What went through my mind was not that pronunciation, let me tell you. Okay. But having said that, I'm thinking. Highways are racist, and of course, right. They're separating cities, and you address that in this book. By the way, folks, Jack Cashel is my guest. I'm so lucky to have Jack Cashel, as well, of course, as PI Susan Daniels, author of a new book herself, with me here in the studio. But Untenable is the name of the book. Please go to Amazon right now and get a copy of this. I guarantee you, you're going to. This is a book that I enjoyed reading because I learned a lot about Jack, but I learned a lot about why things are happening the way they're happening today. And it's both an easy read and a heavy read. It's heavy on the heart a little bit, but it's it doesn't come across that way. It's hard to describe. It really is. It's one of the few books that left me. If you were to ask me what this was about, I would say Jack's experiences, but really about the reason why there is this white flight from the urban areas. And it's deep. It really is deep, but it's not that of a, it's not that. Difficult of a read. Again, the name of the book is Untenable. Jack Cashel is the author, and he's with me, and I'm so glad. But yeah, how can a highway
be racist?
Yeah, be racist.
Well, I know something about this because the highway took our house.
Yeah, I read that.
For those of you who are driving east, it was I-280. It was an unnecessary road. There's reasons why it happened, and it affected our lives a lot. In fact, by the time the highway came through, if they hadn't taken our house, no one would have bought our house because the neighborhood had collapsed already or was in full collapse. But so what our highway did, I-280, it divided the white northern half of Roseville, my village, from the white southern half of Roseville, my village.
Okay.
Newark was 35% black at the time. I-78 came in on the southern part of Newark and divided the Jewish northern half of the Jewish neighborhood from the southern half of the Jewish neighborhood. Now, if they were intentionally, as Buttigieg says, and April Ryan, the reporter, asking, how do you deconstruct the racism out of the obvious? Stop this. It's nonsense. So they the highway people, it's a complicated maneuver. It's these dreamers on the one hand and the schemers on the other hand get together and they plot the destruction of America's cities.
I like that. Dreamers and
in Newark, there's more schemers than dreamers.
Got it.
But Newark is, by the way, where Tony Soprano is from. So you have to understand. And that's based on a real live family, the Boyardos, who factor into the book. But then I started looking around America to see if I could find a racist highway anywhere. Because what Buttigieg defines it as, they built their highways to separate white neighborhoods from black neighborhoods.
Right.
I could not find a single highway in America that did that. And the first project under the deconstructing the racism thing went through the heart of black Detroit. It went through a heart of a black neighborhood when it was built, just like ours went through.
Yep.
And Newark, the two, went through two white neighborhoods, even though the city was a third black. I mean, if these guys weren't good shots, if they're looking to destroy a black neighborhood or separate one, they missed on both of their attempts.
Right.
And when you look at the reasoning behind they were so casual. I got a hold of the plans for the route, the development of I-280, as it turns out. And they're so indifferent to the lives of the people who live there. You know, some highways I get, they're absolutely essential.
Yeah.
Garden State Parkway was essential. The New Jersey Turnpike, which goes through, doesn't go through a neighborhood. It goes through all these, every stinking facility and known to man lines the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah, and by the way, I've been on both. Interesting rides on both.
They serve different functions, but necessary functions.
Yep.
280 was just because at this point, just like with that public housing, the federal government was putting in 90% of the money. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So you're a local politician or you're a local, you just happen to have a demolition company like the Boyardos did, right? And you own the mayor of Newark as the Boyardos did. And he gets a 10-year prison sentence for as a result of it. You like these new projects, right? And then you have the housers and the schemers, the people who believe that housing can transform lives. Or that highways can transform cities. And they're all in it together. And working class white people were voiceless. We still are.
Yes. Thank you.
And in telling my own story, telling the story of my village, I'm telling the story of 1,000 other villages across the Northeast, North Central United States. You know, I talk about Gary. I talk about Chicago. I talk about, Philadelphia, St. Louis, Detroit. I mean, every city in America was good. There was a village that was suffering what our village was going through. And our village had the advantage for me in writing. Boy, I was lucky in several ways. One is the Berg family, which is, there weren't many Jews in our neighborhood, but one was the Berg family. They had three children.
Mm-hmm.
The two boys are most notable, Samuel Berg, doctor, and Mo, Morris Berg, his brother, younger brother. Samuel took photographs of the entire neighborhood. And they're on collection. So I can look, I was able to see my entire neighborhood, what it looked like in 1960.
Okay.
And let's just make 1960 a benchmark year.
Okay.
Every shop was filled along the main commercial street, Orange Street.
Okay.
90% of them were indigenous to the neighborhood, home-owned. You know, there was the Italian grocer, the Irish baker, the Greek merchant, the Chinese food store, the optometrist, the paint store, the flower store, the bars. When I talked to the people who grew up in my neighborhood, the word idyllic kept coming up. You would not think that a neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey in 1960 would be idyllic, but that's the word I kept hearing. Kids, we loved it because we could do everything. We could walk everywhere. We had total freedom to go any place we wanted to.
Right.
There was no service we couldn't access. The streets were safe. Right? 1960.
Wow. Okay.
By 1972, when my friend who gives me the word untenable leaves, the block is a hellhole. You can't live there anymore. It's become untenable.
So, okay. And you captured that so well in the book. So tell me, why? What the hell happened?
What happened was what Daniel Patrick Moynihan predicted. And that is that the families, families with wayward children from broken homes were flooding the neighborhoods. There was no effort to understand that this had the potential to undo neighborhoods. So, for instance, there was only about a half a dozen single-family homes among the 83 homeowners, 83 households on my block.
Okay.
Among my childhood friends, we were the only ones with a home of our own. And it was an old fixer-upper. My father was very handy, fixed up. We had a boarder living on the second floor, though. I mean, that was not uncommon. And later, then my grandmother moved in. But we were the only ones with a home of our own.
Okay.
And when a neighbor about two houses down, it's about 1963, moves out, and already, the signs are with the highway coming through, people are getting antsy. To that home moved three families with single mothers and 16 children among them.
Oh.
Now, it becomes a racial thing because they were black and that the Great Society targeted black people and succeeded in a bizarre way of flooding them, inundating them with benefits if, and here is the catch, there's no married father in the home. You don't get Medicaid. You don't get food stamps. You don't get a rent based on income. You don't get AFDC if the old man stays in the home.
Okay.
And so there's a huge incentive to for fathers to leave the home. It became economically more feasible for mothers not to have a father.
So as a, you could actually have a father with a job in a home, again, working part of the family, maybe not making very, very much money, certainly minimum wage, but you could actually do better without him there.
Right.
With government assistance.
Yeah.
Okay. Go on.
And every time they laid on a new benefit, they gave black families or any families, because there were some, you know, in fact, there was a white family and a black to fit the same pattern. They came in with their two slutty teenage daughters. And my mother used the word, they're sluts, as though, what? That's a disincentive, Mom? They were so slutty, they were beyond the range of comprehension. But when you give people, each time you add a new program, you give an additional incentive to maintain and do this. Right. Boys without fathers in a home is a problem. But a neighborhood without fathers, now you're talking jungle. You're talking total dysfunctional, nightmarish neighborhood. And the story of like Columbus Homes, which is a story very well told
You're talking about a high rise now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Where that multiplies on top of itself, where all these, you only need 1, 2, 3, 4 kids on a block to destroy the block.
Right.
And when 2, 3, 4 of them get together. And so in our case, our neighbors were relatively benign. They had a couple of boys our age. They were, you know, they weren't problematic, but they have friends.
Right.
And the friends would come by and they'd hang out. And now you have problems. You have conflict. And immediately, you know, we're drawn into that conflict.
Okay.
So it was changing. And so people would say, oh, the neighborhood's changing. That's a dog whistle. It's a code word. Kind of was. But everyone understood what it meant. It didn't have to be black, because there were some bad white families coming in under the same circumstances.
Sure.
But predominantly, since blacks were the ones who were targeted by the government, they were the ones who suffered most and suffered worse.
Okay. The left had catered to specifically the black families, if you will, creating the situation that you're discussing, if I'm hearing this correctly and if I read this correctly. And they created the problem and, of course, exploited, maybe this is trite to say, but they exploited the solutions as well.
That's right. So they would not, to acknowledge that they created the problem was more than they could do. They're not known for their honesty and owning up to things. So what they did, and they looked for scapegoats.
Okay.
And the scapegoats were us.
Yeah.
And there were millions of us, you know?
And to me, that describes, too, this white guilt. When I watch these TikTok videos where you've got a white young lady who goes on and says, I won't date anybody but a black guy or a black man or whatever. I'll never date anyone who's white. Or you'll have white Caucasian men or women, young and old, on there. This white guilt is so evident, and I just never understood. For me, it's difficult to understand. And I think a lot of our listeners and viewers are like that. What the hell's going on with that?
Well, that's a good question. What I talk about in here, because one friend, I interviewed about 50 people for this.
By the way, folks, John
many of them
Tenable.
From my own neighborhood. Many of them I hadn't talked to in 50 years or whatever. And there was one guy said, no, I got the guilt beat out of me a long time ago. And so from that generation of people, the people who left Newark when I did, there's no guilt. You don't hear that. You never hear that. Maybe from their children, because they're severed from it.
Right.
And they... If they've been re-educated badly enough, they see their parents as some sort of dinosaurs or, you know, racist and whatnot. The more honest you are about your own upbringing, the more racist you seem to them, which is why I would totally recommend this for parents or grandparents who need to explain to their children what their family went through, how they ended up living in a nice suburb now, you know, and not in a third floor walk up in a crowded city like Newark.
In fact, expand on that if you don't mind. I mean, I tell people, go out and get this book. You've got to read this book. But your target audience, I mean, to me, it's everyone with a working brain, because you really explain the story of this white, this white flight from American cities.
Right. My original title, Doug, was Dispossessed. And then it was the unsung story of America's great ethnic diaspora.
Okay.
But when I ran that title by people, they said, what's it about? What are you talking about? I said, no, I got to be a little more specific.
Right.
But I wanted to tell the story of the dispossessed, the people who left. And this is... So the book is, you know, some parts of the book are kind of funny and upbeat, and they're, you know, it's not all doom and gloom at all. But
I just like the, if I wrote this down here, the, hang on a second. What's an Irish seven course meal? It's a six pack and a
boiled potato.
Right. And I can say that because.
We talk about jokes because at the time, when I was a kid, you were allowed to tell jokes about other ethnic groups.
Right.
To them. Right?
Right.
And you'd exchange jokes. And blacks were beginning to be pulled into that, which was a good sign.
Right.
In other words, if you could tell a black joke to a black, and by the way, there were always black people in my life. I mean, they're always there everywhere, you know? They were neighbors, they were friends. You didn't generalize about them because you knew them individually.
Right.
Thus you didn't have this sense of guilt, like you didn't know any black people, or you always said, I had to have a black best friend. You didn't need that because they were there.
Yeah.
So the one time I get officially mugged, the first time, makes a newspaper.
I remember reading that. It's fascinating.
I know there's a pair of black hands over my eyes. I thought it was my friend Earl, because, you know, kids do that to each other all the time. And I say, hey, Earl, what's going on? You know, I could sense the hands were black. And then I feel someone going through my pockets. And I said, well, that's not Earl, you know. And I turn around. I see these three black kids running away. And that's one of the stories. It's kind of I'll tell the story now because it's kind of
semi-cute. And your father was chief of detectives?
He was a youth aide detective.
There you go.
He was two blocks away. So when I got home, first of all, my mother is tough old bird, and I knew she would be where I think I stole the money. You know, it was her first thought that I had a $5 bill. I stuck $3 in back pocket. I went down to the store.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so I'm 9 years old. I'm trudging home. I'm less traumatized by the mugging than I am by the fact that I got to tell my mother that I'm missing these $3 because I know she's going to be suspicious.
Yep.
So I get home and then I finally convince her that this is a true story. And she says, those black bastards mugged the wrong kid, you know. Now, I never heard her use the word black before, because it was a word then, it was kind of a negative word.
Right.
There's no profanity ever used in my house. I've never heard my father ever curse. My mother would say damn or hell every now and then, but bastard was, oh yeah. So she was pretty sincere. She calls my father. He comes back, and we walk down to the scene of the crime, which is on my block. Mm-hmm. It's about 50 yards from a public school, about 50% of whose students are black, right? This is a grade school.
Yep.
So we walk over to the public school, and this is, for me, it's mortifying. I know, you know, half the kids in the school, and I got to go from class to class trying to identify these kids, and I only saw them from behind, right?
Right.
So it was going to be tricky, although I saw the one kid's shirt.
Which was a rayon shirt.
Right, which is pretty common at the time. And I'm looking for this rayon shirt, and I'm not seeing it. I'm going from class to class. Finally, we're in the last class. This is literally a true story. I remember it like this.
And by the way, your dad's not, I mean, with each classroom, your dad's believing in you
less.
A little less.
Yeah. You know, he's thinking maybe the kid did pocket the $3, you know. And $3 in 50 years ago was like $20 today. So we get to the last class. It's a true story. And there's this goofy kid in the front. His friends called him Monkey, so I can say that, but... He sees me walk in and he goes, and I said, Dad, I think that may be one of the guys, you know? So, my father says, son, could you come up here in a second? And he jumps up and says, I didn't take that boy's $3. So my father says, son, let's go down to principal's office. Right. So we go down to principal's office. He rats out the three kids. It turns out the kid with the rayon shirt had a quilted front and had a rayon back. So his front, I didn't see the front. So I was vindicated. And then, you know, the kids were remanded to the custody of their parents or whatever. It makes the Newark Evening News because it's such a quirky story.
Which, by the way, I had something similar happen to me. When I read that, I thought of a situation in my own life. I'm not going to get into it, but very similar to that, obviously. But you had mentioned something about the principal. When your dad took you to that school.
Right. She said, the first thing she says is, and she's a big, heavyset white woman, and right. I don't know much about her. She's got a lot of jewelry. I remember some details like that.
A big, heavyset white woman. Yeah. Go on.
And she said, none of our boys would do anything like that.
Of course not.
And my father said, well, you know, your school is about 50% black, and you're about 50 yards from the scene of the crime. So it's very possible that one of your boys did do something like that. So then she said, well, go to South 8th Street School, which is a higher black percentage, right. About a mile away. And my father said, well, let's just start here, ma'am, right? So when we're leaving after the kid's been busted, he says to me, the only comment I ever heard in my family about Jews, and he deduced her Jewishness. I would never have thought in those terms. She goes, the problem with Jews is they think coloreds can do no wrong.
And to be clear, the woman who said, no, not here, none of our students would do anything like that, was Jewish.
Yes.
Okay.
And I lived in a heavily Catholic neighborhood. And, you know, I've heard that, you know, we had no problems with Jews. They right. They owned half the shops on Orange Street. And they weren't in part of our world. It wasn't a thought we had. We never, right. you know.
Right.
But it was the first time I ever heard my father venture a comment, like an ethnic generalization. And there's some truth to it. And he made no comment about the fact that I was mugged by black kids. It struck us then as an anomaly, you know, just like a one-off, these things happen. But it became less and less of an anomaly over time. And so when I interviewed the 50 or so people I talked to, virtually every one of them have a story, an enough is enough story, an untenable story. When one crime too many.
But you get into the... how can I put this? The Jews protecting or accepting, but protecting the blacks.
And it's become, you know, and this is where whiteness becomes a useless generalization.
I mean, to their own peril.
Right, to their own peril.
Add. Yes, right. Yes.
Philip Roth, the novelist, talks about this a lot in his stories. And he's from Newark, and, you know, he was a useful guide in many ways, but... it's interesting because, you know, the outside experts, white flight, white, 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 white. We didn't think of ourselves in those terms at the time.
Right.
If you're Irish, Irish, you're Italian, Italian. We didn't say Irish American or Italian American. We just said you're Irish. You're right. Italian, you know, you're Jewish. There's a book written about the class, the Weak Wake High School class of 1958, which was virtually all Jewish.
Okay.
And it was written by a woman who was in the class of 1958. Her name is, I believe, Sherry Ortner. And at that time, in 58, Weak Wake was probably the best high school in America without a selective entrance exam, you know, where anyone
right.
could go.
Right.
Jews, their vulnerability in Newark was their high standards. I mean, they were easily the most accomplished ethnic group in Newark. I mean, that okay. was true nationwide. In terms of income, in terms of success, in terms of academic achievement, they were way, way beyond the rest of us, collectively. And so they expected a lot from their public school, and that was their vulnerability. We went to Catholic school.
Mm.
Italians and the Irish went to Catholic schools. We didn't need the public schools. They did. So in 1958, Ortner... you know, interviews a lot of her classmates, a high percentage of them. She said 60% of her classmates, and she's now a distinguished professor at Columbia, went on to become roughly what you call among the 1%.
Right.
Which is, you know, for a public school in Newark in 58 is really astonishing. And then when I was looking at what happened to Weak Wake in the years afterwards, and comparing it to my neighborhood high school with Barringer, which was largely Italian, is an interesting contrast. In 58, Weakwake, she said, had a handful of blacks. And she makes the point that Barringer was filled with racist, the Italians, and but the Jews of Weakwake were you know, upstanding, and you know, they welcomed blacks into the neighborhood, and they'd have committees where they'd greet blacks and help them, you know, assimilate.
Right.
Which is fine. It's, you know, it's noble. And yet by 1970, I got a hold of the 1970 Weakwake yearbook, 400 students in the class, 13 white students.
Wow.
Three of whom I would identify as Jewish. I didn't see a single white face in the undergraduate classes. Barringer, wow. My neighborhood high school, despite the fact that they infused the whole group from another black high school, was still 49% white. So the Italians didn't cut and run. They fought it out, you know? So the problem was that if you cut and run, white flight. If you stick it out, you're racist, you know?
Well, yeah, you lose.
You lose. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Wow. All right. This to me, I mean, you look at what is taking place all across America today, and again, you capture what's going on, the emotion, the facts, the events, everything in your book, Untenable. Folks, please, again, you can flash that on screen if you'd like, but Untenable is the book. There it is right there. It's on Amazon. Grab a hold of a copy. This is a pre-sale. It's actually coming out on the 4th, I believe, right?
Right, July 4th. Right.
Okay, fantastic. This is a really great read, and this is about the white ethnic flight from America's cities. Folks, you really, I mean, to really gain a comprehensive understanding of what's going on, Untenable does it. Jack Cashel does it like no other, and you know Jack is a fantastic writer, so I really appreciate that. But so with what you've lived through, your story of your village, which is really the story of all of America, what would you say? I mean, I guess the bottom line here, my question is, where is this all headed? Where are we headed? If we keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I got a good preview of that about 2 or 3 weeks ago when I participated in a reparations debate.
A reparations debate. Here we go.
And it was televised in Kansas City on their public TV station. And I learned a lot. And it was not a good lesson. It was a useful lesson, but not a good lesson. First of all, it was staged by a group called the American Public Square, okay, which is a left-leaning entity, but it means well.
Okay.
You know, they staged these very formal debates on, you know, contentious topics. I participated in one about 6 years ago on Muslims, and it was done fairly.
Yeah, and by the way, folks, you can have leftist, in the truest sense of the word, leftist, as opposed to, you know, some whacked out communists that mean well, or they intend well. So without being hyperbolic, okay? So, yeah, okay, so you're involved in this. Go on.
6 years ago, I did the one on, and I would say these are liberals, old school liberals who organize right. This. It's pretty highly, it's very well done, very well calibrated, and they had a fact checker there on the scene who was legitimate. They had a civility bell. If someone got out of hand, they'd ring the bell. Now, and on, even though Muslims would seem like a contentious debate, it was fair.
Okay. You know?
And the fact checker came to my defense a couple times because I come armed with facts.
Right.
They don't. They're so used to just saying whatever they want to say, you know.
Right.
And the civility bell guy came to my defense a couple times too because they couldn't even ask a question of me without getting angry, right? And he'd ring the bell, you're getting out of control.
And it's familiar, folks.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
So the highlight of that debate came when we were talking, I think, about Trump's the ban on certain countries.
Right.
And I said, you know, there's like millions of people around the Mediterranean and Middle East who believe that ISIS is doing a good thing, and they support ISIS. Fact check. Yeah, I get a fact check. The Yale fact check.
Jeez.
Fact check comes back. According to the Pew Research, 60 million Muslims think or support ISIS. I said, that's a whole lot of Muslims. I mean, that's I made my case for me. So that's the way it works best. The audience is 9/10 liberal, you know, but
right.
They're getting a little dose of reality. They try to skew the debates against the people like me. But, you know, if I'm there, they're going to lose the debate. I'm like that kung fu expert at the end of the bar, you know. I don't want to get into a fight. When you want to pull me into the fight, oh, you're going to get me in your head shot.
Right.
So this one, here's the difference. American Public Square again.
Yeah.
I said, sure. So the organizer reaches out to me. I said, yeah, sign me up. I didn't hesitate.
All right.
I wanted to participate in this from even before. Then they're coming back to me. They can't find the second person to be on my side. They can't find the second person to take the against reparations. Now, I talked to all my friends, for instance. Did you talk to anyone? And they'd say, preposterous, for a stupid idea, never get off the ground, horrible. Well, if you're not going to resist, right? Finally, the last thing they wanted was another white guy, right? So they had to go through all their Rolodexes for non-white guys. And finally, as a last recourse, they used and he was good, was the local conservative talk show host guy, and a guy named Pete Mundo. But he wasn't their first choice by any means. They probably went through 10 or 12 names before they could get someone.
So the problem was that they couldn't find who the type that they wanted, is what you're saying,
right? Well, they couldn't find anyone who represented corporate America, any government representative. I know they reached out to certain council people. They couldn't find anyone of a level of respectability that they wanted.
Boy, that should tell us a lot right there. Go on.
So, that's the problem. It told me exactly what I wanted to need. What I was afraid of. So they finally get the two of us, and there's three on the other side. When I walk in, introduce myself to people, I'm just being civil and friendly, you know.
Yeah.
The one guy won't even look at me. He won't get up and won't shake my hand, right? So this is off to a slow start. Yeah. Where's that civility bell? Back in the green room, we need a civility bell. So the debate commences, and I started off, what I did with when I did the Muslim debate, I did a little Sun Tzu on them. I want to attack them in their strengths, right? You know?
Okay, yeah.
So you don't point out the obvious. I want to say Muslims are terrorists. I said, here's what I don't understand about liberals. Why is it you support a group that are more socially conservative than social conservatives? And then I cited their issues, how they felt about all these issues. You know, abortion, about, you know, gay rights. I said, you know, about, yeah. Anti-Semitism going through.
Yeah.
And I had studied my Pew numbers. I knew I had them all down.
Okay.
And so they were flustered because that's not the argument they expected. You know, they expected me to say, well, they're terrorists. They both, you know that. So no, I said, why are you? And I put it back on them. So what I did is when I started the reparations debate, they asked me some, you know, questions, some technical questions. I said, I brought it back to root causes here. I want to establish something. I said, let's go back to the year 1958 and you're Fats Domino and you're turning 30 and you look around and what do you see? Well, first of all, you've made a boatload of money. Then you also see the military was desegregated 10 years earlier. Major League sports were desegregated 10 years earlier. Now blacks are coming to dominate Major League sports. You look at the family intact, black families, black community, safe, strong, black streets, safe. And you're feeling real good about the future. That's why music of the 50s was so upbeat. And that's why I listen to 50 stations.
Okay, sorry about that. This is a good place can you stay with me?
Sure.
Okay, good. We're at the end of the hour, folks. Jack Cashel, the book is Untenable. Part two is going to air tomorrow. And you've got to tune in because there's even more on the other side of this. The book, again, Untenable. I've got it in my hot little hand. Because I know the author. This is pre-sale, of course. It becomes available July 4th. It's Untenable. And this is about the true story of white ethnic flight from American cities. The reason behind it, the reasons behind it. And I've got to tell you, he's got a way of really putting things. And, you know, there's a lot of things taking place. You and I, we speak about this. And Jack Cashel, of course, writes well about this, but you and I speak about this, and there's answers for you in this book. Don't forget, of course, this Sunday, our interactive meeting on Sunday night, 7 p.m. Have a surprise for you then. But they're going to be back with Jack tomorrow, part two of this and more. Thank you, and appreciate your belief and trust in this platform.